Welcome to Econ Talk, part of the Library of Economics and Liberty. I'm your host, Russ Roberts, of George Mason University and Stanford University's Hoover Institution. Our website is econtalk.org, where you can subscribe, find other episodes, comment on this podcast, and find links and other information related to today's conversation. Our email address is mail@econtalk.org. We'd love to hear from you. Today is March 14th, 2012, and my guest is Don Boudreau of George Mason University. Don, welcome back to Econ Talk.
Good to be here.
Our topic for today is debt, particularly the national level, and particularly focused on the U.S., although we may bring in some issues related to debt around the world. But we want to try to get at what is a very complicated issue, which is often called the burden of the debt. Is there a burden of the debt in the future? Some people say that when the United States borrows money today and pays it back down the road, as long as the bonds are bought by Americans, the phrase we often hear is we owe it to ourselves, and therefore there's no debt burden. There's no burden of the debt on future generations. A lot of people find that unintuitive, and we're going to talk about whether that's true or not. And we're going to draw on some writing of Paul Krugman and also of James Buchanan, I expect, in talking about the different views of debt. So I want to start with a family that goes into debt to buy a house. Is there a burden of that debt in the future? What's sacrificed and what's gained, I think, is useful. Again, a lot of people argue that that's a bad analogy for debt at the national level, but I want to start with the family level, the personal level, because I think it's a useful way to set the debate and discussion. So when a family borrows money to go into debt and goes into debt to, say, buy a house or to have a lot of fun, is there a burden? What are the costs and benefits to the family?
Of course there's a burden. There's a cost. Jim Buchanan, we shouldn't get into it here because it gets way too esoteric. Jim Buchanan himself distinguished between the subjective cost and the objective cost. But speaking just in plain language, when you undertake a project that you have to pay for, whether you pay for it out of current income or whether you pay for it out of future income, you have to pay for it. You have to give up something at some point to pay for whatever it is you consume today. Let's recognize at the very start that just because something has a cost doesn't mean it's not worthwhile. Almost everything has a cost. So to say something is costly doesn't mean it's not worthwhile to do. Let's also make the related point that just because something is financed with debt does not necessarily mean that that decision to finance it with debt is irresponsible. There are many good reasons for financing things with debt instead of out of current income. Buying a home is, you know, typically regarded as one of the more responsible things to finance with debt. So there's no moral opprobrium that attaches universally to debt.
So let's talk
public or private.
So let's talk about the that family. So if I go into debt and I borrow $250,000 to buy a house, and I'm going to presume that I expect to have the wherewithal to pay that back. An interesting case.
And the mortgage lender expects it too.
That's the point, right? Yeah. So when a private individual, until this recent dysfunctional era of U.S. mortgage markets that is sort of coming to an end, may not. We don't know what's going to happen. But historically, if you wanted to borrow a lot of money, your ability to borrow was limited by the expectation of your ability to pay it back. Of course, things can happen that are unexpected. Inflation is one. Losing your job is another. There's all kinds of reasons that you might have trouble paying that debt back. But the mortgage lender knows that and takes that into account. It's part of the reason they have to be compensated with interest, which is clearly one of the costs at the personal level of borrowing money. You have to pay back more than you started with. And at different times, that burden is going to be different because of different interest rates. and inflation will change what actually happens. You have an expected payment in terms of what you're going to have to give up in consumption. It may turn out to be different if inflation is different than is expected, which it often is. But if I'm going to go and borrow that $250,000, the lender expects me to be able to pay it back. Now, what that allows me to do, what does that allow me to do?
It allows you to transfer future income into the present, in effect. You and the lender both make an estimate. Obviously, it has some amount of risk associated with it. But you and the lender make an estimate that your future earnings will be sufficiently large that your lack of liquidity today, your lack of cash today, should not be a barrier to you buying this asset or buying this consumption item, however you classify it today. So you're, in effect, telling the lender, look, I'm going to make this future income. I'd like you to advance me that future income today, and I will return it to you with interest in the future. The lender makes a similar assessment, says, I believe that you will have sufficient future income. I know that I believe I know well enough that you will have the future income, so I will advance you that future income on your promise to repay me. So it allows, going into debt allows us to transfer income from our future into the present.
Now, let's take an example that's different from a house. Now, the house, by the way, is the collateral. It's the insurance policy that the lender has that things might go awry. And of course, the value of that collateral is uncertain, which we're seeing right now. Sometimes it turns out to be less than what was borrowed ex post. But ex ante, it's not going to be generally if things are working as they should. But let's say I go out and instead of borrowing $250,000 to buy the house, instead I borrow $250,000 and I throw – with the house as collateral. I own a house. Mm-hmm. And I go to the bank and I own it free and clear. And I go to the bank and I say, I'd like to borrow $250,000, called a line of credit or an equity loan, and because I have equity in the house. And I'm going to take that money and I'm going to throw a party for a bunch of my friends, a heck of a party, mm-hmm. for may it be a lot of friends. And I'm going to spend $250,000. It's pretty clear what I've done in that case, which is?
You've spent a lot of future income to have a really big party today. You know, as subjective as we can't say for sure or absolutely that that was wrong. I can't get into your mind if you do that. But most people looking at that can make a fairly non-controversial statement that you're behaving irresponsibly. You're spending $250,000, you know, assuming that your income is roughly what it is. If you're Bill Gates and you're spending $250,000, that's one thing, but you wouldn't have to borrow the money if that were the case.
Well, I'm going to disagree with you. Yeah. I don't think there's anything irresponsible about it. I've decided, and again, maybe this is the Buchanan distinction, but this is subjective on my part. I've decided I would rather have a lot of fun now and a lot less fun later.
Let me concede. At the individual level, there is no way we can say this is – there's no way an outside observer can say it was good. Some people do behave irresponsibly. You may wake up in the morning after your party.
I might regret it.
Even if you had a great time. You may think, boy, I wish I wouldn't have spent all my – you know, $250,000 of my future income in order to have a one-night party. But you're right. There's no way, at least at the private level, one adult can second-guess the decisions of it.
And the only reason I gave that example is that it's pretty clear there's a burden.
Yeah. You will.
I pay a price for that.
Yes.
It may be worth it. It may not be worth it. You're suggesting it seems unlikely it's worth it. I agree with you in the sense that most people don't do that at our income levels. But my point
is if your child did that,
I'd stop them, maybe. Depends how old they were. But the point is that you would never want to say, well, it's only a loan, so it's free to me. Right.
Yeah.
A child actually, you know, one of the fun things about child raising is that, you know, when you go to the grocery and you give them this little piece of plastic and they give you all these bags of groceries, that looks like magic. Mm-hmm. And you explain to them, well, it's not so magic. They go and take stuff. That this giving them the card gives them the right to take a lot of stuff out of my bank account.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, it's not free. Looks free. Looks like you just pass the card through this magic device, the scanner. You know, my card gets kind of warm after a while because I've been running it through too many times. And so when you go out and you borrow $250,000 to throw a great party, the costs are in the future. The benefits are today. The costs are in the future. All you've done is transfer future benefits into current benefits, mm-hmm. which means you have lower benefits down the road because not only do you have to pay back the $250,000, but you have to pay it back with mm-hmm. interest because you've had access to the money. You might die. You might not keep your job and keep your promise. So along the way, the lender is going to require both collateral typically and a premium for letting you use their money.
Right. And in a world of inflation, a premium for the lender to bear the risk of potentially higher than expected inflation.
Meaning when you pay back the money, it might not buy as much as it did before.
Yeah. And so the lender does want to get paid back. And if the lender thinks that he's going to get paid back, or it's going to get paid back in dollars that are worth less than he loaned, he's going to attach an inflation premium to the interest. In this example, and I don't want to get ahead of you, but it's important to point out here that the person who pays for your party, in common sense, the person who pays for your party, no one would say it's the bank. Yeah. No one would say it's the bank's depositors. It's you.
Yeah.
And you don't escape that payment just because the money advanced to you today to buy your party paraphernalia and food and drinks comes from a third party. You know you have to repay it, and so the burden is on you to repay it. And the fact that you don't – that burden doesn't become manifest on you until sometime in the future does not mean it is in any way a lower cost to you than if you pay for it out of $250,000 that you had sitting in your bank account. In both cases, you pay for it.
And I want to add another twist, which I think will come in handy when we try to generalize what generalizes and what doesn't in the national debt case. The fact that I can push the cost to the future rather than today is tempting. Mm-hmm. Now, part of that temptation is rational because I might not be here when it's time to pay it back. Of course, the bank knows that, makes it – that's why there's collateral, right?
And a premium
– an
interest premium above the pure time preference aspect.
Absolutely. Yeah. But it's always tempting to push off costs in the future for benefits today. And as adults, we try to learn that. Our children struggle to learn that. Our children in general want benefits today and costs tomorrow and have trouble putting aside money mm-hmm. for the future. As adults, we have had some experience with that, and we realize that that's a irresponsible, immature, whatever you want to call it. But inside of us, benefits today and costs tomorrow has a tremendous appeal for obvious psychological reasons.
Evolutionary reasons probably.
Yeah,
too.
Right. Yeah. And so you've got that urge to borrow money, and the marketplace tempers that urge. It forces you to pay a premium, as we've been talking about. And if you mess up and you buy something like an extravagant party, as fun as it is, it turns out not to be as much fun as going 20 years of living badly to pay off the loan. You then learn that that was a bad deal. Mm-hmm. Ex ante, it seemed like a good idea, but that is before the fact. After the fact, turned out so well. And as you grow up, you learn to try to anticipate those feelings of regret and consequences. And I would argue that's what growing up is. That's to a large extent what a key part of being an adult. Do you want to say anything more about
the initial level? Well, let's reinforce that. Everyone knows that, you know, in spite of our protestations about the sanctity of subjectivism, which I agree with.
The sanctity of what?
Subjectivism, uh-huh. You know, and we can't second guess third part,
another other people's preferences
and behaviors. Yeah. Everyone knows. I mean, the world is full, at least the industrial world is full of a lot of people who have credit card debt that they wish they didn't have, that they now regret having.
That the toys they accumulated, the TVs or the cars didn't bring as much
pleasure. And regret,
pleasure.
Not just in the sense of they wish they could have got these things for free. We all wish we can get what we consume for free. But regret in the sense that, boy, I wish I had more self-discipline yesterday or last year and would not have borrowed the money for whatever it is I bought so that I wouldn't have this credit card debt hanging over me today. And we all understand the temptation to consume now and delay the costs until to the future. And, you know, modern credit institutions allow us to do that, although, as you point out, the interest rates do temper that that proclivity.
And the flip side, you started to say it actually because it's such a useful phrase. The flip side is delay gratification. Instead of saying, I want the fund now and I'll pay for it later, what savings is all about, as opposed to borrowing, what savings is all about is saying, there's stuff I want. I can't have it right now. I could, but I'm worried about the consequences of that. So I'm going to delay my gratification, have it when I'm ready to pay for it and the costs are not as high.
We're both parents, and I'm sure the case is true not only for you and me, but for every parent. No parent has any trouble teaching his child to enjoy things now. We don't have to say, no, Junior, you want to consume, you want to have more fun now. You want to have more fun now. Part of what parents teach children is to delay gratification or the importance on many occasions of delaying gratification. It would be a very odd little human being indeed who didn't have to be taught that by parents or some guardians.
There aren't many frugal children.
No, it's just not natural.
Yeah. So I just got to add just a footnote. I think one of the great lessons of time management is the importance of understanding the difference between important and urgent. There's a lot of urgent things that are not important. Mm-hmm. And if we only do the urgent things, we don't end up having time for the important things. And
Absolutely.
So let's turn to the national level and let's ask, do these lessons that we have been and implications that we've been drawing for debt, do they apply when a country goes into debt, when a nation we should be careful. I want to use the word a government, not a nation. Mm-hmm. When a government borrows money, spends more than it takes in revenue, and there's different things, of course, government can finance with debt, and we could debate with the appropriateness of some expenditures versus others. So we could talk about in a war that threatens the very essence of a country's survival, whether that's a good thing to borrow money against, whether it's to have a party at the national level, whether that's a good thing, transfers to special interest groups, infrastructure, which in general would have a future benefit that would stretch over time.
Assuming the bridges aren't to nowhere.
Right. As long as the bridges are to somewhere, they're bridges that the private sector wouldn't build very well. So we can talk about a range of government activity, and I think the extremes would be at one end, payments to friends, meaning special interest groups, such as farm subsidy payments, or to my mind, worse, building things that are not productive. That is the use of real resources which often involves payments to friends. So the people who build the bridges to nowhere benefit, but you're not just giving them a check. You're actually getting them to pour concrete and use up real resources. And at the other end, an attack on a country that its very survival's at stake and goes into debt to finance the war expenditures. So let's talk to start with about differences, if any, between the case that we just talked about at a family level versus the national level.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that there are a lot of a lot of similarities, a lot of things that are identical. Not everything is identical. When you make a private decision to borrow, you're not imposing a cost on anyone other than yourself, or, you know, perhaps your immediate family. But we can regard that as one unit,
unless you lie about your income or ability to pay it back. You could impose costs on other people,
right? But there, you have your credit rating suffers if you're found out of falsifying a document. So there are a great deal of similarities. The analogies between private and public debt hold in a lot of ways, but there are differences.
So you just gave one that's important.
I think it's a vitally important. It's a vitally important difference
because it confuses, I think, a lot of the discussion, as we'll see. But
yeah.
So the first difference is that in the case of let's call it personal debt. In case of personal debt, I make the decision and I bear the costs. And in the case of the public debt, there's a whole bunch of different people are going to be involved in that decision. It's not just one decision-making unit. Mm-hmm. And the costs and benefits are going to fall on different people. We'll get into that. What other differences do you think are important?
Oh, I think those are the main – I think that's the main difference. You have this – you have a lot of – I don't know the right word. The decision-making process to go into debt and the decision-making process for who will repay – that determines who will repay the debt and how it will be repaid is very different in both circumstances. And we lose sight of that when we talk about the nation going into debt. We lose sight of that when we speak about – when we speak as if we have one big collective mind choosing to incur debt today and being responsible for repaying that debt in the future. Actually a related difference then is that – or well, I'll just leave it at that for now.
Yeah. So the one difference I think that's – there's one other difference I think that's important, and this certainly is going to be an argument that the justifiers of borrowing are going to invoke. So like many other issues in economics, unfortunately, this particular one we're talking about has ideological and methodological baggage alongside it. So historically, and by historically, I mean over the last 80 years or so, people who want government to be bigger typically are going to be people who are associated with a Keynesian view of macroeconomics, mm-hmm. and a view that borrowing is overly feared, that we should be less fearful of borrowing. Mm-hmm. Those of us like myself, yourself, who like to see a smaller, more limited government, tend not to be Keynesians and tend to be fearful or perceive the cost differently than the other side. So I want to get that on the table to start with, because it's easy to talk about this as if it's a pure economics conversation, but there's political and ideological, I think, baggage alongside that we should be honest about. And I want to try to bring it out on both sides. But to give due to those on the other side of our view, the people who say that when government borrows, it's not as bad, or it's cheaper, or it's more justifiable than at the personal level. So public debt's very different than private debt. One of the arguments they make that I think is correct is that I, as an individual, cannot borrow perpetually. I cannot live beyond my means in general. There may be moments when I borrow, for example, to pay the buy the house, but then I'm going to pay it back. And it would only be an unexpected outcome that would allow my net borrowing to be other than zero, meaning I lose my job or whatever. Right. So I can rearrange my consumption.
But over time, you can't consume more than you –
more than I produce, other than through good fortune or bad luck on one side or the other. And that means – and the reason is that the lender, you know, when I'm 80 years old and retired, it's a lot harder to borrow – money than if I have a nice full-time job.
No one's going to give you a 30-year mortgage when you're 80.
Correct. Yeah. Well, you might if it's short and small enough and you have other assets. But in general, it's a lot harder. And the reason is two reasons. One is that you die. And the second is because you die, your lifetime earnings pattern has typically an inverted U-shape, that when you're younger, your earnings climb. And as you get older, they fall. Part of what borrowing allows you to do is smooth the consumption over that, rather than living poorly and then living well and then living poorly. Most people, for human psychology reasons, just the nature of our satisfaction in life, want it to be a smoother stream and not as jerky. So, but that's different at the national level.
I'll concede that I'm not sure how relevant that is actually for the thrust of the arguments that are made to excuse gargantuan public borrowing.
I like that term, gargantuan. It's a nice
yeah.
A neutral term, Don. But I think it's relevant in the following sense. In a minute, we'll give some examples and we'll see whether it's how relevant it is or how irrelevant. But certainly – if a nation is productive, meaning if it has good institutions and good laws and its people are innovative, as the United States typically is, and our productivity is growing over time, our product is growing, we have productivity. And as a result, it's possible, may not be desirable, but it's certainly possible at the national level, as it is not at the individual level, that the U.S. could perpetually, the U.S. government certainly could spend more than it consumes. Somewhat akin, and I hate to bring this up, but it's, I think, useful. I say I hate to bring it up because it can end up just another level of difficulty to the conversation, but certainly a nation can run a trade surplus over a long period of time, meaning it can consume more than
– a trade deficit.
A trade deficit, sorry. A capital account surplus if nations want to invest in the United States by having a stake in our assets, if those assets are productive and growing – we can at any point in time consume more than we produce as a country. It's not debt, as you have written many, many times, and I agree. I've written a few times, but we certainly agree on this.
Yeah.
It doesn't have to be debt at the trade deficit.
It's not debt
trade
by identity, that's
level.
For certain. Yeah.
What?
It's not debt by identity.
Right. But that's one way in which a nation can consume more than it produces year in, year out even. And I think Great Britain did it for decades over its history, maybe over,
no,
a century,
the
over a century.
The United States has done it for nearly, you know, with a few relatively rare exceptions, for 400 years.
Yeah.
You know, what is today the United States?
So, and certainly then, if we're talking about, let's move away from the trade issue and talk about public spending, the U.S. government, as I mean, it's desirable, but the U.S. government can year in, year out, spend more than it takes in revenue, as long as the world finds that investment in U.S. government debt to be attractive and there's confidence that the U.S. government is going to be able to pay back those promises and keeps those promises. That when a nation reaches either a size of debt or a problem with its inner economy and tax revenue, that it can't do that, that's when you have a default risk. But in theory, unlike an individual, certainly a nation can borrow perpetually if it does not over-borrow and stays within its ability to repay. Agree or disagree?
Well, yes, of course. but the same can be said of a corporation.
Yes, that's
so
true.
So it's not, there's nothing special about, in the way that you've laid it out here, there's nothing special about a government. Now, the government does have a special ability that private corporations don't have in the modern world, and that is the government has a monopoly over modern governments in today's world. Today's governments have a sovereign monopoly power over the money supply. That gives them an added attractiveness to borrowers. Excuse me, to lenders.
To what? Well,
it gives them a special. If I know that you have. If you tell me that Uncle Sam is just giving you, Russ Roberts, the exclusive monopoly power to print as much or as little dollars as you want, I'm more likely to lend to you because your risk of default is a lot lower. If your income doesn't rise, then you can always revert to the printing press to pay
me.
Yeah,
I disagree with that. I think that's a negative for the lender. I think.
Oh no, I don't think so at all. I mean, the lender, the government can abuse the power, of course. It can cause inflation to be so high that lenders no longer wish to be repaid in those. But you know,
it reduces the risk of absolute default, but it creates the risk of a implicit default. It seems to me that
from the perspective of the individual lender, it does
China?
Not.
You think China is comforted by the fact that the U.S. can print money when it lends it money? I think it goes the other way. I think China is anxious, and they've explicitly said so, that there's a temptation on the part of the U.S. government to inflate the debt away. And I think it's a very real risk.
Well, they're still lending money to it. They're still buying American bonds. I mean, I think from the and perhaps I haven't thought through this. Perhaps there's a difference between very, very large lenders acting as a single entity, such as a major foreign government.
Yeah.
But I think at the individual lender level, the individual who goes out.
When I go and buy a treasury.
I think the fact that the government has access to a printing press at the margin makes it more attractive.
But I thought you were going
less attractive for you to lend.
What I thought you were going to say is that its ability to tax.
Well, it has that.
I think that's the real comfort. Unfortunately,
it has that as well, of course, and that adds to it too, because. But even that it can be abused. If the tax power, much like the inflation power, if it's overextended, then you know the government can be thrown out of power.
Oh,
the economy can collapse. None of these things is guaranteed. But yes, the power to tax, the power to issue money created de novo at the margin, at least for the relatively small lenders, makes lending to the government more attractive than otherwise.
Okay, so let's now turn to Buchanan's insights into this. Buchanan, 1958, wrote a book called
Public Principles of Public Debt,
which took what I would – I had not read the book until recently. We Don and I talked about this podcast topic and got me to read some of the book. And Don's written about it at Cafe Hayek, our blog together, and I'll we'll put up some links to that to those posts. What I think is creative, in a way, it's kind of so straightforward. It's you could argue it's not creative, but it sometimes it's hard to see things that are out in the open. What Buchanan's done in that book, and we'll put a link up to it. It's the entire book will be is up online at the
at EconLib.
At EconLib, at no charge. It's a very short book. Mm-hmm. It's a very dense book. He thinks very carefully and slowly about this.
It's only about 160 pages in print, but
it's complicated.
It's about 800 pages
in thinking.
Yeah,
I got to read it a few times. I read it very slowly. but what I think is useful about his approach, and quite important and striking, is he very explicitly rejects the notion that the national government borrows money and repays that money as if it were a single individual, because we know we're a nation of different individuals, and the people who lend the money, the people who get the government spending, the people who pay back the money, and the people who receive that payback are all different people, different groups of people. And so Buchanan's simple point, in a way, is that you have to take that into account. You can't just say we owe it to ourselves. And I think because there's no ourselves.
You can't get misled by Keynesian aggregates, is what he's saying.
Yeah, there's no ourselves there. There's different groups within our country that borrow the money and pay it back and receive it. And I think although there are, I think, very little in the first part of the book that is explicitly about Keynesianism, there is an implicit Keynesian aspect to this, which is that to some extent in the Keynesian view, aggregates are what matter, and things wash out because of that. Whereas in the Buchanan view, and I would say my view and yours, they don't wash out all the time. So let's go through that. So let's start with Buchanan's argument of a government. Again, we don't have to distinguish between what kind of government spending it is. Let's walk through who pays for it and who gets the benefit.
Let's assume that the government spending is regarded by everyone as being justified. Right? So no matter what that might be, it's justified. Buchanan, excuse me. In 1958, was reacting against the what was then a fairly new theory of public finance. He called it the new orthodoxy, and it emerged in the 1930s, right along with Keynesian economics. And it served, although it was probably not strictly necessary for Keynesianism, it certainly served the Keynesian agenda, and people who accepted it were Keynesians. They bought into it. Because if you bought into it, and I'll explain in just a moment what the it is. Well, if you bought into it, it made you less – you didn't worry about debts that you encouraged the government to undertake. So the it, this new orthodoxy, the new theory of public finance that emerged in the 1930s was that because the debt doesn't come due until sometime in the future, to the extent that that debt is payable to people within the same political community that undertook that debt, then the debt is not a burden.
That is Americans, in the case that most of
let's talk about America.
As long as the borrower, the lenders are Americans, people who buy the Treasury notes are Americans.
Because it's so important in Keynesian economics for the government to be able to borrow, this is, you know, functional finance, and because prior to Keynes there was, for better or worse, there was certainly in the economics profession. A bias against government indebtedness in peacetime. The Keynesians had to at least psychologically to get rid of that, you know, because we have to be able to go into debt even during peacetime in many occasions. And the Keynesians then were able to say, look, because the debt is owed to people in the future, and because those people are citizens of the same country we belong to, it's no problem. We owe it to ourselves. That was the famous phrase that justified the debt. So it's not a burden. Buchanan said nonsense. Buchanan said, look, let's look at the individuals involved here. We have citizens / taxpayers who somehow participate in the political process. We have politicians who obviously participate in the political process. We have lenders. Well, these will be people who buy government bonds, lend money to the government. And then we have future taxpayers, people whose tax bills will rise when the debts come due. And we have and the bond holders, they can be either the same people who lent the money today, or they can be the heirs of the bondholders.
Or the people they sold the bonds to.
That's just
confusing. I think the other, there's one other group, which is the people who benefit from the spending.
And the people who benefit. So,
which could be the nation as a whole if we're fighting off an invader, or it could be the friends of.
So let's take a war the war example, which is the example most people would regard as, you know, the most justifiable use of debt when the threat is real and imminent. We all believe it's real and imminent. So government today borrows $1 trillion to fight off an invading enemy because it doesn't have the liquidity today. Private lenders, and let's assume they're all American.
We're going to play within the Keynesian rules as much as we can here. So the borrowers, people who bought, no foreign holders of U.S. debt in this story.
Yeah. So Americans lend voluntarily $1 trillion to Uncle Sam. Uncle Sam spends that money effectively in winning the war. America survives. The debt comes due 30 years from now. All the holders of the bonds are Americans. Uncle Sam honors its debt commitment. It raises taxes or reduces spending. Let's assume it raises taxes. The story is not fundamentally different. It raises taxes 30 years from now to pay off the debt. So some Americans have to pay, or Americans in one capacity have to pay higher taxes. Americans in another capacity receive the principal and interest on the debt that Uncle Sam took out 30 years earlier. Buchanan says, even though we do agree in this case that the debt was justified, it is still a burden. And the people, and this is the crucial part, the people who bear the burden of that debt are the future taxpayers, the taxpayers 30 years hence whose taxes rise in order to pay off the debt. The fact that, number one, the beneficiaries of the debt holders 30 years from now are citizens of the same country, the people who paid the debt, that's irrelevant. That doesn't mean there's no burden to the debt. The fact that the resources to fight the war were, of course, contributed and literally consumed 30 years ago does not mean that the people who contributed those resources voluntarily bear the burden of the debt. Those are the bondholders. They chose to lend the money to Uncle Sam in return for additions to their financial portfolios that, in their view, made them
better off.
So they're not the ones who are bearing the burden of the war. The burden has to fall somewhere, and it falls on the people who pay off the debt, and those people are the future taxpayers. The nationalities of the bondholders when the debt is redeemed is utterly irrelevant. The burden is shifted to the future, and it's real. It's not reduced just because, number one, it doesn't exist today at the time the debt's taken out, and number two, contrary to what the Keynesians say and contrary to what Krugman says, it's not reduced just because or disappears to the extent that the bondholders are citizens of the same country as the taxpayers whose taxes rise to pay the debt.
So I think in the Buchanan story, the way to see it is that the bondholders, the people who lent the money to the United States, and obviously some of them die, they have heirs, and that just confuses things again. That's not relevant. So let's assume, mm-hmm. Make an unrealistic assumption for the sake of understanding the underlying economics. Mm-hmm. Let's assume they're all still alive mm-hmm. When the debt comes due. It might be a 5-year bond.
Yeah, some of them will be.
Some of them will be, otherwise they're heirs. So they're better off mm-hmm. slightly by the attractiveness of this opportunity to lend the money relative to other opportunities to lend money.
That's right.
The people today are who receive the benefits of the government spending. They're not killed in the war as a result, or it could be that they have better bridges and roads.
And we can even say the people in the future who pay it off.
I'm going to get to that.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah. And it could be these benefits extend over time
yes.
because we're not enslaved.
In our example, I would assume they do.
Yeah, they're not enslaved by a foreign power, or mm-hmm. they get to enjoy the bridges that were built.
Right.
The special interest payoff is a slightly different story. We could talk about that later, but you can work that through at home as an exercise. So whatever those benefits were, which we think are huge, mm-hmm. we're not disputing the value of the benefits, it's clear who pays for them. It's in one dimension. It's a little unclear, but in one dimension, it's clear who pays for them. The people who have to finance the taxes to pay back the bonds plus interest.
Oh, I think it's completely clear who pays for it, and it's those people.
Well, the reason I want to say it's not so clear, mm-hmm. here's why I want to say it's not so clear, and this is a confusion that may be unproductive. We'll see how it goes. And this is why this is such a difficult topic. When the government in the present convinces would-be savers to give their money to the government in the form of bonds, mm-hmm. other things don't take place. Mm-hmm. And if the government were to say, we are not going to fight this war, mm-hmm. those other things would take place, and some of those investments would be productive. And so those resources today
– Yes. That's true. But that's true. That's true for any economic decision taking, whether it be political or private.
So I think the right comparison – is to talk about a war financed by taxation mm-hmm. today versus debt, which is, mm-hmm. as Milton Friedman would like mm-hmm. always would point out, that's just taxation tomorrow. Mm-hmm. You can call it debt, but mm-hmm. when government finances its activities, it's either financing them via taxes today or taxes tomorrow. Mm-hmm. And Friedman used to always say, and I think it's in agreement with Buchanan.
Oh yeah, it doesn't. It sounds on the surface like it contradicts it, but it doesn't.
I think it's the same point. Yeah. What Friedman used to say is, if you're debating government activity, don't be fooled by whether it's financed by debt or taxes. Just look if it's worthwhile. Mm-hmm. If it's fighting a war to save us from destruction, it's worthwhile whether you finance it out of taxes today or taxes tomorrow. It might make sense to do it out of taxes tomorrow, but certainly it's a good idea. If you're doing it to build bridges to nowhere or dig ditches and fill them back in, it doesn't matter whether you finance them out of tax today or taxes tomorrow. It's still a bad idea.
The what Friedman's saying is the full cost of the cost of government activity today is the amount of money government spends today, not the amount of explicit tax revenue it takes in today. It's measured by spending and not taxing.
And that borrowing doesn't somehow allow you to have a free lunch.
That's right.
Right? So, yeah. So let's walk through that a little slower to make sure that's right, or at least that we're comfortable with it. Because the alternative facing this terrible war, instead of borrowing the money, mm-hmm. we could have said, folks, this is really bad. I mean, we could think of two mm-hmm. ways to finance a war. We could think of three ways, the way we just talked about, which is we're going to borrow the money, take the borrowed money and buy stuff with it to fight the war. Mm-hmm. We could – which is, quote, voluntary on the surface because it's taken from people who choose to buy the bonds. The involuntary part comes on the people who have to pay it back.
Which is an important point that we should
get
to.
No, it's huge. Yeah. We're going to come back to the politics because that's part of the political incentives that are at play here. But it looks voluntary, but it's the same involuntary thing. You just push the involuntary part to the future.
That's exactly right.
Alternatively, you say, folks, bad news. We're about to be attacked. We're going to have to
raise the taxes by $1 trillion this year.
And that's going to be painful. It means less private consumption. And the only difference between those two is which Americans end up paying the price. It'd be a slightly different group, which is one of the reasons the political incentives.
But note, in both cases, the people paying the cost of the war are the taxpayers.
Just different points in time.
It's right. The fact that the taxpayers who pay it in the borrowing case are in the future, and the taxpayers who pay it in the taxation case are in the present, does nothing to change the fact that the burden falls on the taxpayers.
Okay. So now the third way, which I'm going to begin, there's a fourth way too, but I'm going to start. Maybe I'll stop.
We can skip money creation.
No, I'm not. I'm getting away from that. I'm not. That's not my third or fourth. Okay. That's the fifth way. That's again a different kind of tax. It's an implicit tax.
Yeah. It doesn't change the fundamentals of the story.
But here's the third way: the government could expropriate private resources. Mm-hmm. It could say one of the things that
that's a form of taxation.
Just I know, but I just want to. Yeah. It's very clear who the burdens are.
Yes. Yes.
The government could say, "We're going to. We need transportation in this war. We need to move troops around, and we need to fly airplanes." So.
Yeah. Yeah.
U.S. Airways, Southwest, we're coming to you. We're taking all your planes.
Mm-hmm. To hell with the Third Amendment. We're going to quarter soldiers in your house.
Right. Yeah. And we're going to steal all the buses. All in your cars are all going to become government. Now, everybody would understand in that case, you wouldn't say, well, there's no burden because we have the cars that we still own our cars. We all understand that whatever those cars and buses and trains produced for us in benefits, as you said before, it might be worthwhile. Yeah. To use them to fight this terrible external enemy. We would never want to say, well, it's free because we own the cars. We still own our cars.
That the people getting the benefit from the seizing of Southwest Airlines and the seizing of private homes and hotels to quarter soldiers or Americans, that doesn't make it free. Well, we seized it from ourselves. No one would say, that makes it go away. That makes the burden go away. We seized it from ourselves.
Now, and it's clear what the real cost is. The real cost are those private benefits and pleasures would have had from travel and comfort in our homes, et cetera.
Right.
And by the way, the same thing with food. We got to pay for the food for the soldiers.
Yeah,
so we're coming to the farms and we're taking your crops. And all that does is change who pays for it. It doesn't change the fact that there's a burden of it or that there's a price to be paid.
That's exactly right. Yep.
Now, and most people would argue, well, we ought to spread the burden widely because we're all getting the benefits of this security from this foreign
invader. That would be true. That would be correct.
And so, therefore, it's not right to just punish people who already own cars, happen to own airplanes. Let's spread the burden.
That's why there's a just compensation requirement in the Fifth Amendment's Takings Clause, for example.
Yeah. Okay, so I think we've made some progress. Now we're ready to.
Did you list all the ways to pay for it?
We could ask for donations. Was the way I was thinking. We could ask people to voluntarily give.
Oh yeah, in which case they would be the payers.
They would be the payers, yeah. And I think in the background of all of our conversation, which both Keynesians and classical economists, and I would put you and I began the classical camp
in this case, yes,
the pre-1930s view of debt. What everybody agrees on is that there were some distortionary effects that might differ across these different methods. The form of taxation matters, whether the tax system is well-designed. There are extra costs from that.
Yeah.
But we also all agree that that's relatively small compared to what we're talking about.
Yes.
Okay. You want to say anything else before we go? I want to switch gears here. Okay. So now this is we're 49 minutes into this, and now we get perhaps to the hardest part, which is I'm going to take a quote from Paul Krugman and see if we can apply what our claims are so far, and see if we can disagree with him in a useful way. So Krugman explicitly, in a column that was written January 1st, 2012.
January 2nd edition of the Times. That's right, yeah.
Right. It was online on January 1st, but it came out in print January 2nd.
I know the column well.
Yeah, Don's written on it, and I've been chewing on it since he got me to think about it. Here's what he wrote. And then what I want to try to do, just to sketch out the rest of our conversation, I want to try to address the Krugman point, and then I want to go to the really large picture issue of sovereign debt generally and whether – we're in a crisis or not, which seems like we are in some dimension. Greece is still embroiled as we record this in some serious problems. Spain and Italy seem to have problems. And a lot of people say, well, that doesn't apply to the U.S. Other people say, oh, my gosh, we're going down the same path. And
yeah, John Taylor, for example, is worried that we're
right.
Not there yet, but close to it.
I'm a little worried about it myself. So here's the Krugman quote. And it applies perfectly to what we've been talking about. He just has a different view. And by the way, those of you who written me, I appreciate it. You encourage me to have Paul Krugman as a guest. I am eager to have Paul Krugman as a guest. I prefer to have Paul Krugman defend himself than have to read him. I've invited him. He has not responded. It could be he's not interested. It could be he's never gotten my emails. If anybody knows him out there and wants to encourage him to come on, be happy to have him. Sure, it would be lively and interesting. We'd both learn a lot, or at least I would. So, but here's Paul Krugman's words.
He would too.
Oh, who knows? I would not presume. Here's the quote. Deficit worriers portray a future in which we're impoverished by the need to pay back money we've been borrowing. They see America as being like a family that took out too large a mortgage and will have a hard time making the monthly payments. This is, however, a really bad analogy in at least two ways. First, families have to pay back their debt. Governments don't. All they need to do is ensure the debt grows more slowly than their tax base. The debt from World War II was never repaid. It just became increasingly irrelevant as the U.S. economy grew, and with it, the income subject to taxation. Second, and this is the point almost nobody seems to get, an overborrowed family owes money to someone else. U.S. debt is, to a large extent, money we owe to ourselves. This was clearly true of the debt incurred to win World War II. Taxpayers were on the hook for a debt that was significantly bigger as a percentage of GDP than debt today, but that debt was also owned by taxpayers, such as all the people who bought savings bonds. So the debt didn't make post-war America poorer. In particular, the debt didn't prevent the post-war generation from experiencing the biggest rise in incomes and living standards in our nation's history, close quote. Now, before we talk about it, I'm going to let people chew on that quote. You might want to rewind and hear it again. It's a long quote. I apologize for the length of it, but I wanted both to be fair to him and to – it just so perfectly captures the alternative view to what Don and I have been talking about. But I want to just reemphasize his points. First is that governments don't have – he makes two points. The first is that government doesn't have to pay back its debt. It can roll it over. And the second is that it's not harmful. There's no burden because we owe it to ourselves to the extent that U.S. taxpayers are the holders of the debt rather than foreigners. And again, I want to give him the benefit of the doubt and assume that that's still – that's not literally true, but it is to a large extent.
The argument he's making is that he admits that his argument in that part of it applies when the debt is internally held.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So
and
what's wrong with him? What's wrong with that argument? Is he wrong?
Yes.
Why?
Well, first of all, let's you didn't point this out, but it is true, of course, that the debt incurred to fight World War II did not prevent America from growing economically, right? Well, again, just because a debt has a burden does not mean that it's not worthwhile. Just because an expenditure has a cost does not mean that expenditure wasn't worthwhile.
Yeah, that part of it is really
strange. Well, and also, you know, this is a you know, sort of a also post hoc fallacy in a way.
Correlation isn't causation.
You could have someone here who makes a strong. I mean, let's assume. Someone said, you know, these expenditures were completely wasteful. And yet, America grew. Therefore, these wasteful expenditures
weren't wasteful.
Were in fact not wasteful. You know, maybe America would have grown even more.
Right. That's the problem.
Right. I mean, so that's. But we can forgive him that. It's a column for a newspaper. We all write sloppy things.
Simplified things.
Some of us, I write sloppy things sometimes, which I regret. The heart of that claim is that because, or to the extent that we owe it to ourselves, it's not a real burden. That is a mistake. This is the claim that Buchanan so carefully examines and exposes as fallacious in many of his writings, most notably in the book that you'll put online. Buchanan wrote in 1958. By the way, and I've searched his blog and I've looked at his columns, I see no evidence that Krugman even acknowledges Buchanan's contributions. Buchanan may be wrong. I think he's right, but perhaps Buchanan is wrong. But in 2012, unlike say in 1957, you cannot make the claim that Krugman makes as if it is an established, indisputable truth that only untrained economists
disagree with.
Yeah. You have to deal with Buchanan's argument. You have to show why Buchanan is mistaken, and that Krugman doesn't even attempt to do, as far as I can tell. Maybe he's done it elsewhere.
Well, but he doesn't need to, because it's obviously he's going to—
Well, the way he dismisses it, in that, at least in his newspaper column and on his blog, he dismisses the Buchanan view as—
Irrelevant.
As if it's a fundamental, as if it's a flat earth kind of claim.
Yeah, it's irrelevant.
Right. If American A has her taxes raised so that American B has his bond redeemed with those taxes, the money stays in America, but that doesn't mean there's no burden to that debt. The taxes are still raised. Krugman will admit there's a slight, as the Keynesians admitted, there is a slight burden, the distortionary effects of having to raise marginal tax rates,
yep.
Right? No one denies that. But the absolute amount of money paid from A to B does not disappear as a burden just because B is a citizen of the same country as A. And that is what Krugman is suggesting. So here's where the politics comes in. Let's get away from the war thing, because we all agree that war is necessary.
If you're under a threat of imminent invasion.
Certainly there are a lot. I think much of Uncle Sam's belligerence is wasteful.
But to pick a better example, I'll take the example of that Krugman
stimulus spending.
No. I don't want to take. Right. I want to take a. There's an asteroid about to hit the United States, and if it hits, everybody understands on its current path, it's going to devastate 330 million people, kill them, and destroy all our stuff. So, we've got to build a complex set of activities to shoot it down out of the sky.
Let's back up for a moment. His claim can be dismissed this easily, right? The resources had to be spent to fight the war. Resources have to be spent to destroy the asteroid. Resources have to be spent for corn subsidy. Resources are being spent today with borrowed money. That money has to be repaid. The need to repay is a burden. It's not reduced as a burden just because it's funded with money borrowed today and taxes put off in the future. Would Krugman say? I suspect he would not, but would he say, let's suppose the war were funded out of current taxes, going back to your previous example. You wouldn't say, we're paying those taxes to ourselves. Therefore, these people who worry about the cost of the war, they're absurd because most of that money's being paid to us. It's still a cost. Again, it may be worthwhile, right? We can agree that it's worthwhile. That doesn't mean it's not costly. It doesn't mean it's not a burden on the people who pay the tax. And this is the problem because current taxpayers, current participants in the political process, by being able to borrow through government, are able to consume more today than they otherwise could. Oh, I get to have I get to have whatever goodies government's going to give me without without my taxes or anyone else's taxes rising today, then that creates an incentive, because we all like to spend other people's money, that creates an incentive to spend more today, right? So at some level, the fact that the burden can be pushed off to other people, particularly people who aren't voting now, they're voting only in the future if they vote at all, and if they can even identify themselves, that creates a not logically necessary, but it creates a politically likely scenario in which the government today does spend more money than otherwise. It does use up more resources today on projects today that it would not otherwise engage in if those projects had to be funded out of current taxes. Because they don't have to be funded out of current taxes, then government spending rises higher than it would otherwise rise. Right? You cannot say that the cost of those programs, right, whether they're necessary or not, disappears just because taxpayers in the future will be the ones who see their tax bills rising in order to pay off the debts when the bonds come to be redeemed. Right? And that's what Krugman wants to say. He says, oh, you people are so dumb. You don't realize that, you see, we're paying it to ourselves, so it's not a real cost. Again, it's easy to see when you recognize it. You wouldn't say that if the programs are being funded out of current tax. You would say, oh, there's no real cost. There's no real cost to this program because, you see, we're taxing some Americans and giving the proceeds to other Americans. So it's not costly. Of course it's costly. And the cost is being paid by the people who have to pay higher taxes. It makes no difference at all whether those taxpayers are existing and paying the taxes in the current fiscal period or if they're paying the taxes, if they exist and paying the taxes in future fiscal periods. So they are the ones who pay. And the burden is no lower. In fact, it's probably higher because the incentives for government to spend more money today are raised due to the fact that the cost can be pushed off into the future.
So the way I see it, I think that's beautiful, but here's the way I would suggest to challenge Krugman's view and really hope Mr. Krugman responds maybe in the comments section if he doesn't want to be a guest on the program. Or some of his friends will, I'm sure. So I invite people who think he's right to comment on this podcast in the comment section. But the way I think about it is, it is a danger. It's a slippery slope of intellectual reasoning to say we owe it to ourselves, because on the surface, it would seem to justify any size of government spending because there's no burden. So for example, let's say it would cost $1 trillion to fight off the invaders or destroy the asteroid or whatever it is. So $1 trillion. Mm-hmm. But let's suppose the government decides out of political reasons to spend $4 trillion, mm-hmm, to make a much bigger effort against the asteroid. Turns out to be a mistake. It isn't necessary. It turns out we could have just spent $1 trillion, but while we're borrowing, let's borrow $4 trillion.
And this is why, I don't know, this is why, see, if people believe the Krugman view, then they're more likely to accept that, because to the extent that the electorate thinks, oh, well, it's not a real cost because we owe it to ourselves, then why would they care how much government spends? Right. Oh, if it's not a real cost because we owe it to ourselves, then by all means, reduce that risk even further by spending not just $1 trillion, but $4 trillion. Why not $40 trillion? Because we all owe it to ourselves. It's not really costly.
And if the government borrowed enough money, as each individual borrower decides whether it's worthwhile or not. And one of the complications we've left out here, which I suspect would be part of Krugman's defense if he were here, or someone else's defense, is that interest rates are going to perhaps be different if you went to borrow $4 trillion versus $1 trillion. You'd have to pull resources out of private sector the buyers of the bonds to induce them to buy $4 trillion, you'd have to offer maybe a higher interest rate than you would if you were only doing $1 trillion. I worry that complicates things. But put that to the side. If the government goes and borrows $4 trillion, that means there's less stuff that's created today. If they requisition not just the airplanes for the war, but the cars too, just in case. You wouldn't say, well, because we're going to pay back, say, the car owners, suppose we borrow the money to buy the cars from the private sector rather than confiscate them. So if we borrow, again, three methods. We can borrow the money today to buy the cars from people so that we have them for the work. Turns out they're not necessary. It's totally unproductive.
Right.
We could tax people today to finance the money to buy the cars, or we could just confiscate the cars.
Requisition them.
In all three cases, we don't get the benefits of using the cars. We hope that it's the benefit. There's a future. There's a benefit from defending ourselves. But if it's a mistake, if it turns out that we shouldn't have taken the cars out of circulation and all they did was sit around in government parking lots, you wouldn't want to say, well, if we used borrowing to finance them, then it didn't cost us anything. It obviously cost us the fact that we can't have our cars. The people who would pay for it would be different. In the confiscation case, it's the people who own the cars. In the current taxation case, it would be the people who are paying taxes today. And in the debt case, it's people who are paying taxes tomorrow. Those are the people who financed the use of cars in the war. You wouldn't want to say there's no burden.
Look, take a simpler case. Suppose the government it's a new transportation policy. The government just requisitions cars from people in the top 50% and gives those cars to people in the bottom 50%, right? So we're just giving it to ourselves.
Yeah.
Right? Now, you can think it's a good policy. And I will concede for argument's sake here that let's assume it is a good policy. God dictates it's a good policy. So we all agree it's a good policy. That does not mean that that policy has no that does not cost Americans. It costs the people whose resources are confiscated. It costs the car owners whose titles to those cars and ability to use those cars are stripped from them. And the fact that the cars are given to other Americans does nothing to reduce the burden of those people who have to pay for the policy.
I don't know if that's a good example or not. I don't know if I agree with that. I agree with your point. But I would argue that's probably different than what we've been talking about in that that's a reallocation. The total – at least you can argue correctly that the total number of cars hasn't changed in the United States.
Well, so let me extend it. Right? If government had this power to do this kind of requisitioning, right?
Yeah.
What would happen to the amount of requisioining that it does? And then what would – well, that's the marginal tax point, right?
Right.
But yes. The point of my example here, right? I agree. It's a little bit different than the debt thing. But the point of my example here is simply to point out that just because the person who is taxed, in my example, a car is taken from him or her, is a citizen of the same country as the person who gets the proceeds of that tax, the other American who gets the keys and the title to the car, right? That does not mean that there's no burden, that Americans in fact pay no there's no cost to this program. There is a cost. It's borne by the people who lose their cars.
Yeah, but I think Krugman would agree with you there.
I think to be consistent, he wouldn't. He's saying that there's no burden except for the marginal, you know, the marginal tax point, the marginal tax rate point. There's no burden when in the future future taxpayers are taxed in order to pay future bondholders. What's the difference? The fact, okay, they're in the future, so?
No, I think he'd say, let me.
I think he would not, he clearly does not want the two, and we're picking on Krugman here. This is the view held by a lot of people prior to when Buchanan wrote. Krugman's just resurrected it. He does not want the two to be the same, but I think they are the same in important respects, not in all respects, but in the essential respect that just because the people who have resources confiscated are citizens of the same country to whom those confiscated resources are transferred does nothing to reduce the burden of the program.
Well, I'm not sure, but the point I want to make is we're short of time. I want to try to close out here, and I want to try to make a slightly different point that I think gives Krugman his due, and I think keeps his that viewpoint. I think it's consistent in a way you've suggested it's inconsistent. And I think fundamentally what the defenders of of debt spending are saying today. And the sovereign debt issue, we're not going to talk about. Yeah. Obviously, everybody agrees, people who want bigger U.S. government debt now and those of us who are opposed to it, that if you make it too big, you could eventually risk default. The debate right now is it too big now?
Mm-hmm.
And there's arguments on both sides. You could argue that we're in perilous waters. You can argue there's nothing to worry about. I'm going to wish we had time to talk about that. We don't. I want to make a different point. I think the fundamental reason that Krugman makes the argument he does and people like him who are arguing for bigger debt is that when they say there's no burden, I think fundamentally they're talking about aggregate demand. I think they're saying –
Yes.
The reason there's no, quote, burden
– Yes, I agree.
– is that because they I think
– They're focusing
the, – I'm going to call him Keynesians. I'm going to get away from poor Mr. Krugman.
No, Krugman wouldn't.
He's certainly a Keynesian, but let's talk about Keynesians generally. Keynesians are worried about aggregate demand.
Mm-hmm.
And to that, and they're worried about spending. Mm-hmm. And those of us who are classical argue that that's a misplaced emphasis, and maybe often wrong, but certainly a misplaced emphasis. In that, while it is certainly true that in the future, when bondholders are repaid by taxpayers, there's no net change in aggregate demand. Then that doesn't mean it's free.
Yeah.
No. And of course, where I think what is strange about that view of the Keynesians is that. It's also true today that when we tax people today, when we issue bonds today, we're taking money from one group of Americans and giving it to the others, the people who are hired by the government or who benefit from the government spending. In that sense, it's a wash on the surface. So in terms of aggregate demand, they have to argue that, well, the people who were lent the money were going to keep it in their mattress or some other quote unproductive thing. And that's an interesting argument. We've had conversations with people about that before. But I think just fundamentally, intuitively, why they ultimately look to the future and say, well, this is not a burden is because they're saying, well, aggregate demand is going to be preserved. Yes. So the economy is going to be healthy and we're going to get back on track.
Yes, I agree with that. And even if we concede both the centrality of aggregate demand in a Keynesian way, even if we can concede that it doesn't change when American A has his taxes raised to pay American B. That does not – and I agree. I think that's what motivates a lot of this. By looking at aggregate demand, they say, oh, well, you know, because we owe it to ourselves and there's no threat to the economy. That may be true. That's a separate issue. That's an issue in macroeconomics, right? But it's very dangerous, particularly for someone who has a public voice of the kind that Krugman has. It's very dangerous because it's wrong – to say that the debt owed to ourselves is not a real burden. It makes it appear as if, to at least the careless listener, it makes it appear as if someone like Krugman is saying, you know, it's not cost us at all. As long as we borrow money from Americans and then tax Americans to pay that, then that somehow gives us an ability to get something for free. We get it for free. We don't have to pay for it. Well, if people believe you can get something free, you don't have to pay for it. Why not? Why would you
oppose?
Where's
the budget constraint?
Yeah.
So let's come full circle, and we'll finish up here. Mm-hmm. And let's try to take it back to the family level, which
Krugman does not want to do. Yeah.
Don't accept. Yeah. We certainly. And my punchline, the reason I don't like your car example is that I think that's a reallocation of happiness and well-being among Americans, and you can debate whether that's good or just or whatever.
And all I'm saying is costly. It has a cost.
I understand, but I think the Keynesians would accept that. I think part of the confusion in this issue is definition of cost and definition of burden, and we've given our implicit definition. We haven't explained it literally,
it is an intricate issue.
But here's why I'm going to cut through all that. And again, I want to talk about an expansion of government spending, not a reallocation of existing private consumption.
Mm-hmm.
A family, the head of a family who goes into debt on a get-rich scheme that is flawed.
Mm-hmm.
So I go out and I borrow a huge amount of money to buy up a inventory of a product that I think is going to be a world changer. And it's a loser, it turns out. And no one wants to buy it.
You bought a warehouse full of chocolate-covered pickles.
Yeah, exactly. That's a mistake.
Yeah.
And whether I fund that out of debt, with debt, that is future consumption, or I say to my family, we're going to move into a really small house and we're not going to be able to have any go out to eat.
Mm-hmm.
And our clothes, we're going to have to – nobody can buy clothes and you have holes in your socks and your shoes. Too bad, because we're making an investment. We're going to be fabulously rich because mm-hmm. these chocolate-covered pickles are going to be a huge mm-hmm. success. It doesn't matter whether I borrow the money or whether I give up my consumption today. There's a cost to me.
Yep.
And all that really matters is whether chocolate-covered pickles are a hit.
Yep.
If they're a hit, I'm going to be – yep. It's only a question of when I pay for that investment.
Yep.
And I would argue the part where I think you and I both agree and where we disagree with the Keynesians is that if government goes out and does something gloriously productive, like save us from an asteroid that's going to destroy us, it doesn't matter whether it's financed by taxes today or taxes tomorrow. If it's a good use of money, the only difference is who bears the burden of that.
Right. Right.
But if it goes and buys chocolate-covered pickles because mm-hmm. it thinks those protect us from an asteroid,
mm-hmm.
that's a bad example, because they think it's going to improve the health of the nation, it doesn't matter whether it's taxed or borrowed. Mm-hmm.
Right.
It's a bad use of real resources today.
Right. So to put a codicil on that, the reason we should have a preference for funding government expenditures out of current taxation rather than the future debt is because current taxpayers – are a bit more likely, not perfectly so, a bit more likely than our future taxpayers to be to monitor
the quality of what the government spends the money on,
the amount and the quality, and so because to the extent that government pushes those burdens into the future, it's released from fiscal constraints, healthy fiscal constraints that would exist would otherwise exist today if financing had to be made out of current tax dollars, and then so the For Keynesians to say that, well, if it's pushed off in the future, it's not really a burden. Because if we owe it to ourselves, it's not really a burden. That makes the issue even worse, because then people today would say, oh, well, in that case, we don't have to worry. We're getting something for free. We're getting something that doesn't cost us as a group anything. So go for it. Chocolate-covered pickles. Let's go settle Pluto. I mean, it's all free.
Before we close, I just want to raise one semantic issue and then an issue about expectations, something we haven't talked about. On the semantic issue, the reason I think that Keynesians would agree with you about your car example is they say, well, sure, it's a burden on the people who finance those transfers, but it's just a transfer. The total number of cars stays the same. And I agree with that. And that's why I think it's important to make a distinction between real resources that get used by government spending, regardless of how they're financed and whether they're productive is what matters, versus transfers. Now, a transfer of, say, just pure money, let's forget the car, is a pure money transfer, say, from rich to poor or politically unpowerful to politically powerful. That has disincentive effects because the taxes eventually have to be raised to pay for it. Everybody agrees with that. We may disagree about how large those disincentive effects are of higher tax rates. But I think it's important to distinguish between transfers versus real spending on real resources. Of course, if government transfers relentlessly large amounts from one group to another, the group that's losing their money is going to respond by not trying to accumulate as much. That's the disincentive effect that I think everybody respects. But I think the key in this whole area, we talk about the burden. The Keynesians would agree there's a burden on the people who lose the transfer, who are paying the taxes, but they'd say the net burden, the total effect is zero. And I think they'd be roughly right with the transfer payment, but not with real resources, not when we're building a bridge or tanks or other things that mean we have less today.
Well, you know, I don't want to go to the mat defending that particular example. But here we have a connection between some of Buchanan's most famous work and Gordon Tullock's, some of Gordon Tullock's most famous work, his 1967 piece on, although he didn't use the term, on rent seeking. Obviously, when you're transferring monetary claims, at some point, they're going to result in resource use. The problem with the it's not a burden if we owe it to ourselves discussion and language is that it conjures up in the image of people the wrong impression that if government borrows and if the holders of the debt are citizens of the same country of the government that issued the debt, then it's a free lunch. Then we can pay for all these things. We can get all these things without anyone having to pay for it. It's not a burden. The fact that politicians are spending other people's money, and in this case, they're spending the money of people many of whom not even voting yet. That means they're going to overspend. That means that they will spend less prudently, and they'll spend more than they would if the people who were enjoying the actual resource transfers had actually to pay for them directly.
And that brings us to the last point I want to talk about, which is expectations. We have not talked about the fact that people look ahead. They anticipate consequences in the future that might be set in motion today. The classic issue that's raised in this area is debated as Ricardian equivalence. And what that is often
named after David Ricardo.
David Ricardo. And what people are often talking about there is whether current taxpayers anticipating higher future taxes will offset the alleged stimulative effects of government spending by saving more to pay off their future taxes. And a lot of people are skeptical about that. But what I think no one is skeptical about, and I just want to bring this in as a footnote to the political economy point you're making, I think a lot of future taxpayers are alive today and know who they are. I may have agreed with you a little too quickly earlier on. Obviously, the big debate that's going on right now in America is that people look at large increases in government spending financed by debt and realize I'm not going to enter the discussion right now how they respond today, but they're certainly aware of it. And part of the reason they're opposed to it is they do realize they're going to have to pay for it.
Right. And since they're opposed to the extent that that's true, then they want to keep, it proves Buchanan's point. They want to keep the level of spending and debt down because they know it's not a free lunch.
Yeah, correct.
Right? And look, on the Ricardian equivalence point, I think it's become more of a historical, I think it's more of a sort of an intellectual curiosity than a substantive point. I mean, it may be real in some sense. It may exist in some sense. I think in some sense it does exist. But it detracts from Buchanan's main point. The point is whoever pays the taxes in the future, there'll be taxes that are raised in the future to pay off the current debt. Right? It's possible for people today anticipating that and caring about their children and grandchildren to in fact then set aside more money today than they otherwise would and pass it along. In which case, in those particular instances, that burden is borne by people alive today, and the people who write the checks the people in the future just happen to be the ones who write the checks, okay? And they're just passing along wealth lent to them, given to them, bequeathed to them by their prescient forebears. But the reason that's not empirically important, I think, is that the very reason politicians so readily borrow and spend today is because people today want the goodies today and they don't want to pay for them.
Yeah, whether it's it can end up being them or their children, it's further down the road. So there's some impulse to push that down there.
Yeah.
My guest today has been Don Boudreau. Don, thanks for being part of Econ Talk.
Always a pleasure. I'm indebted.
This is Econ Talk, part of the Library of Economics and Liberty. For more Econ Talk, go to econtalk.org, where you can also comment on today's podcast and find links and readings related to today's conversation. The sound engineer for Econ Talk is Rich Goyette. I'm your host, Russ Roberts. Thanks for listening. Talk to you on Monday.